Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome. I'm Joel Michelson, Chair of the Academic Senate. And on behalf of the Academic Senate, it gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you, Chancellor Yang, members of the UCSB community, and friends of UCSB, to the 53rd Annual Faculty Research Lecture. The first faculty research lecture was presented in 1955, and it has been given annually every year since, except for 1963, and I have no idea what happened in 1963. No riots or anything like that. In any case, this is the 53rd. Each year, the Academic Senate, through its Faculty Research Lecture Committee, selects a nominee based on nominations from faculty for the Faculty Research Lecture. This is the highest honor that can be given by the Senate to one of its members, and it really embodies the essence of the excellence of being a faculty member at this great research university. Looking over the past list of research lecturers, I'm very impressed with the very many prominent and familiar names, even one building. I'm pleased to see that a number of past recipients are here today to honor this year's faculty research lecturer, Professor David Oshlon. And now I'd like to ask Chancellor Yang to come forward and introduce Professor Oshlon.
Well, as Joe just explained, the faculty research lectureship is the highest honor on this campus on research. So today we are most delighted to recognize our esteemed colleague, Professor David Oshlon. I'll say something about David. David earned his Bachelor's of Science degree in physics from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His PhD is from Cornell in the field of experimental physics. Prior to coming to our campus, he was the research staff member and the manager of the non-equilibrium department. Actually, I skipped the physics. Non-equilibrium physics department at IBM Watson Research Center in New York. David joined our Department of Physics in 1991. In year 2001, he took on a joint appointment in our Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. He's the director of our Center for Spintronics and Quantum Computation. He's also associate director of our California Nanosystems Institute. I heard a long time ago that people was telling me that Professor Oshlon from Santa Barbara invented this name called spintronics. So he is the creator of that name. So he's going to explain to you what does that mean. I want to make a whole speech just by listing all of his awards that David has received. So that would take today's speech. So let me just name a few of his prestigious honors just in the last 2 to 3 years. He was awarded the 2005 Olive E. Buckley Prize from the American Physical Society for fundamental contributions to experimental studies of quantum spin dynamics and spin coherence in condensed matter physics, condensed matter systems. He received the 2005 Agilent Europhysics Prize for outstanding achievement in condensed matter physics from the European Physical Society. He and the two others received the prize for their investigation of magnetic semiconductors and spin coherence in a solid state, which paved the way for the emergence of spin electronics, now called spintronics. Dr. Oshlon also received the 2005 Newcomb Cleveland Prize from the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He received this prize along with the Professor Arthur Gossard and the two graduate students, I think Arthur is right there, for their groundbreaking work published in Science Magazine titled Observation of the Spin Hall Effect in Semiconductors. This was the first time this spin hall effect had been seen in an experiment. Professor Archelon is a fellow of the American Physical Society, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He was also elected to the National Academy of Science in year 2007. So in addition to being a leading researcher, Professor Archelon is also an outstanding teacher and mentor. During the 17 years he has been here at UC Santa Barbara, he has mentored 59 postdoctoral fellows and graduate students. 15 of his students now hold academic positions of their own. So I know all of us have been eagerly waiting today's lecture on engaging diamonds in the quantum age. So some of you probably come here to learn how to make diamonds, but actually I talked to Professor Archelon, he doesn't know how to make diamonds, he only buys them. But first, let me take this opportunity to say thank you to David for all of your contributions to UC Santa Barbara and our scientific community. Your brilliant work and the trailblazing spirit are a source of great pride for our academic community. I personally am very proud to be a colleague. And also I want to say thank you to David's wife, Nancy Kowalik. Is Nancy here? Oh, Nancy, I wanted to pay tribute to you. My introduction would not be complete without acknowledging Nancy's unwavering love and support. We are also grateful for Nancy's own distinguished contributions as our colleague in film and media studies and media arts and technology. Nancy is the founder of the director of our professional artist laboratory. I just want to add just one more word. 10 years ago when Professor Walter Cohn, I don't know if Walter is here, when Professor Walter Cohn won the Nobel Prize, I asked him, I said, who, are there any special rising star on campus? Without hesitation, he said, David Archelon, David, I did not tell you this. So he had high regard for you even 10 years ago. Now you just blossom like exactly the way he expected. So now everyone, it's just my great honor and pleasure to introduce to you, and please give a warm welcome to our 53rd annual faculty research lecturer, Professor David Archelon.
But my mother would love you. So thank you very much for being here, and thank you for breaking every known fire code that I can imagine as an experimentalist. I hope I'm referring to this field that'll give you a sense about why my students and I are so excited about this area of condensed matter physics, which aims to really create a new type of information processing technology that's based on both science, engineering, and materials capabilities. And it's a very interesting and exciting and fast-moving field, a field that's moving in ways that none of us could predict. But the one thing I'd like to share with you is the fact that it's not really a new idea. And many of you, of course, are familiar with Richard Feynman, who in a room not that unlike this, posed a series of challenges to experimentalists in the late 1950s. And it's very sobering when you look at this and realize that as a community of scientists and engineers, we've actually met all of these challenges. Well, not me, we as a community. But in the sense of building computers on the atomic scale, instrumentation that can see atoms, machines that can manipulate them, circuits that involve quantized energy levels. But the one challenge that we've yet to really work with is, can we build quantum machines based on quantum spin? And that's really what I want to talk to you about today. And all of us are familiar with spintronics in the most general sense, with permanent magnets. So the reason a magnet is a magnet, like magnetite or iron or your refrigerator magnet, is that all of the electrons of the atoms in these materials are all pointing the same way. Each one acting like a little bar magnet, like in this cartoon in the center, where they generate a net magnetic field or permanent magnetization, a ferromagnet. And people have exploited these for various purposes for a long time. Just after the year 1000, the Chinese made a real industry of compasses, but they would hammer these magnetic materials into thin foils and put them in dishes and use them for navigation. So we're not new with that. And of course, in the 1930s as well, lots of the popular literature began to appreciate the power of magnetism. So How can you argue with that? The nation that controls magnetism will control the universe. And we tell our funding agencies this every day. And of course, magnetism can be used for both good and evil. And of course, our funding agencies appreciate that as well. So I wanted to give a one-slide introduction to the history of spins, and I've been told by a lot of my colleagues in physics that people like this. So I know, is Andrew Cleland here? Yeah, sure. I'm sure he wouldn't be. So right before the year 1900, someone named George Stoney, an Irish physicist, came up with the idea that electricity should have a basic unit. It was a very bold decision at the time. He wasn't sure that there was a basic unit, but he felt there should be one, and he called it the electron. And he looked very distinguished, so people believed him. And about a half a dozen years later, a British physicist that many of us are familiar with, Joseph Thomson, discovered the electron. It was a very exciting development in science. It was the first subatomic particle. It was believed to be a point-like object, and with no internal structure. And he also looks very, very serious. About two dozen years later, a pair of Dutch physicists, and this is where it actually gets pretty interesting, Goudsmit and Uhlenbeck, proposed the concept of the electron spin. And this was a pretty interesting idea, and it was a very brave idea, because people began to look at light that came out of the emission of alkali metals from a spectrum, like a fluorescent tube. And they looked at the spectrograph, and they found certain lines that nobody understood. And so these people came up with the idea that maybe the electron isn't a point particle. It's a little sphere like the Earth spinning around its axis with an electromagnetic field generating a little magnetic moment. And that electrons have both a charge, a mass, but also a spin. So this generated a lot of controversy because people would calculate, well, how fast would this thing have to spin to generate a magnetic field that would explain the data that people saw? And it turned out it was unrealistic. Have to spin at this incredible speed. A lot of letters, a lot of communication. And finally, in the 1930s, just 5 years later, Paul Dirac developed the quantum theory of spin. This was a very big leap in science that you really had to appreciate that the spin of a particle was a quantum object, not a classical object. You couldn't explain it with classical science. So this is what I'm going to harp about a little bit in the talk. But it's fun to look in the literature. And I'd like to say I've read extensively on this, but I only did it this weekend with Google. So you have to bear with me, because I actually don't know more than I'm going to show you. But there's an interesting letter that was sent by a couple of students to this pair of Dutch physicists complimenting them on the fact that they got their paper published on the concept of the spin. Now, I don't expect you to read this, but Wolfgang Pauli, a very famous physicist that many of us have heard of. How many of you have heard of Wolfgang Pauli? Well, the rest of you should Google him tonight. Very, very famous guy. But it's interesting that he said, very lucky that you got your paper published before Pauli even heard of it, because Pauli ridiculed the whole thing. And that's very intriguing, because while he was ridiculing the whole thing, of course, he was working on the idea. And a few years later, received the Nobel Prize in Physics for his decisive contribution to his discovery of a new law of nature, the exclusion principle, or the Pauli principle, which is actually based on the concept of spin. So there are a lot of lessons that one can learn from this. And maybe in the reception we can discuss that in private. And here we see Pauli and Bohr, Niels Bohr, looking at a spinning top a few years later, relishing the concept of spin. And it's difficult to appreciate exactly what they're thinking right now, but you can certainly think, you're way ahead of me. You can certainly think about, you can imagine what the Dutch physicists were thinking at this time after the Nobel Prize. But the one thing that we can sure that they realized that the spin of a particle doesn't point just up or down, but it can point in what's called this quantum state, a superposition of up and down, all combinations in between, something that's hard for us to grasp in physical reality, but it's this weirdness of quantum mechanics that you can create this superposition of a combination of states in just one particle. And already that tells you that this one electron can contain an enormous amount of information if you could harness it. Is there a way to control the superposition of states? And in this nice cartoon by the BBC a few years ago, when somebody asked, how can you conceptualize this? And I said, I have no idea. And they said, well, what about this? I said, sure. Now you could think about an electron with a circuit surrounding it and some sort of technology or some technique to control this quantum property of the spin. Some way you can make it point in all sorts of individual directions. So, just to make sure, as Henry pointed out, we're all on the same page, spintronics just means spin electronics. So in today's technology, like in all of our laptops, circuits are based on electrons that move in small wires, micron-scale wires, about the size of a human hair in width. And for those of you who've used a laptop on your lap, you know it gets pretty hot. And it's because these charges are moving back and forth to these very thin conductors that are resistive, and they generate heat. And that's an ultimate limit in today's technology. You can make small circuits, but they burn up. They become fuses. So an idea has come up, could you actually not move the particle at all? Could you build a technology where all the atoms and electrons are stationary, and you control the flow of information based on the way the spin of the particle points? And could you use this as a way to integrate today's normally disparate technologies, logic, storage, and communication? And I'm going to go into it in just a minute. So the only thing that really matters for learning about spin today is that electron can spin like the Earth clockwise or anti-clockwise, like a little bar magnet, but it can point like a top, precessing, and it can spin in all different directions. So the challenges for this field, if you could control a quantum state, is you don't want to move it. You'd like to get rid of all of the wires in the circuit. For example, in the Pentium chip today, most of the chip is just wire, not devices. If you cut one in half and you look inside, roughly 85% of it's just wire. And you'd like to get rid of that. That's what's getting hot. So from a physics perspective, the challenges are enormous. You want to create a quantum state. You want to move it through a real material without destroying it. You want to manipulate it. You'd like to store it for a while, and you'd like to detect it. There are a lot of very big challenges that about 10 years ago seemed almost insurmountable for a very delicate quantum mechanical object. So one of the most intriguing properties of the particle spin is coherence. So if you have a bunch of these spins and they're all like tops moving, there's a phase between them all, right? Like if you had 100 tops on the floor and they're all spinning, they're all locked in phase. So here we have five of them spinning. You can think about these five waves. At any point in time, they're all locked together. Their amplitudes are all the same. So according to the Britannica, coherence is a fixed relationship between the phase of particles or waves at a particular frequency. Two particles, in this case five, of these waves are coherent when the phase difference between them is constant. So part of the idea of quantum information is you'd like to control these phases, like FM radio. You'd like to modulate the frequencies and control information. So coherence is something we understand. We want to protect them from decohering, or the loss of information. Anything that's some sort of illogical decohering process that will destroy the information content, and there are lots of examples of incoherence, things that make no sense. There's so many things to say, but we'll just move on. So, okay, that was a cheap joke. And as Henry mentioned, before I came here from IBM, we'd worked a lot on developing experimental techniques to be able to directly look at the dynamics of spins in real materials. At the time, we were pretty successful. The times were very short. There were complicated measurements. This is an old photograph of the lab. I just wanted to give you a sense of the types of instrumentation that were needed. And for Gene to appreciate the startup money, actually, substantial for hiring new faculty. We talked about that, right? Yeah. That you require lasers to look at the states, cryogenic systems to cool them to very low temperatures, to control the materials, and so on. But one of the most exciting things in this field happened when coming to Santa Barbara with a group of really talented and hardworking and creative graduate students, where when we continued these measurements, like we often do in science, at the very end of a series of complicated experiments, we do a control measurement. And the original experiments were we're trying to take information from an electron and move it into a magnet. And that worked. And before publishing that result, we said, well, we better do a control measurement and just take a simple semiconductor with no magnets in it and just make sure that the electron spin goes away and you can't really do very much with it. And this is some data taken from a series of commercial wafers of gallium arsenide. So these are materials that are used today in cell phone technologies. They're just bought from a vendor. And these were experiments using this instrumentation to look at the electron coherence. How long could you generate and monitor a quantum mechanical state in a standard off-the-shelf material? This is one of the few samples that Art Gosser did not grow for us. That's not why it worked, but, you know. And what was exciting in these measurements, and the complete surprise, is that these different wafers of commercial semiconductors were the only difference was the resistivity of the material, the number of electrons in each wafer. The coherence time changed many, many orders of magnitude. And in specific materials, you could generate this quantum mechanical state that would last for very long periods of time. A complete surprise in materials that were available forever. You could buy for $10. And if you apply some voltages to these puddles of electrons you could create using these techniques, you could drag them hundreds of microns with relatively little effect on this quantum state. A complete theoretical surprise. All of us had expected that a quantum mechanical state was very sensitive to looking at it or playing with it. And in fact, the data showed quite the opposite. you can move it over macroscopic distance. So 100 microns might seem small to you. When you think about the scale of today's technology, where the wires are just a micron or two, these are huge distances to move a quantum object. So suddenly, this idea of moving quantum technologies into reality wasn't absolutely crazy, and largely based on experiments, not theory. Even though I guess this is the ITP, and I should be careful about that. So all of this was done at low temperatures, at 4 Kelvin, and in the last few years, by learning more from our theoretical colleagues and changing the material systems, this physicist has brought to room temperature, or 300 Kelvin. So on the desktop with no cryogenics, you can generate and observe a quantum state with relative ease, actually. The instrumentation you saw before simplifies enormously. But it's an exciting thing that you take a textbook state, a quantum mechanical variable, prepare it, and play with it in the lab in a commercial material. And for those of you in engineering, of course, and those of you non-engineering, you know that gallium nitride is a very exciting system to look at because it's one of the forefront technologies for solid-state lighting as well. So here we are, and this began to capture the attention of industry. So as they began to read the scientific literature, they realized that, well, when you look at a computer today, if you were to design it from scratch, you'd never seen a computer. You would never build one the way we build one. You have a hard drive with iron material to store information, with magnets, okay, for storage. You use optical fibers and pulses of light for the internet to communicate from machine to machine. And you use semiconductors for logic to build transistors. So they're completely different types of technologies, where what you'd like to do is maybe think about connecting all of them in one block of material, some cube of matter where you could store information, perform logic, and communicate in the same block. And all of the companies that you see here that are seriously involved in using technology and are seeing these limits to today's technology suddenly became interested in a quantum technology. As did the military, because in 2006, a very interesting thing happened. Some of these types of related phenomena were brought into the marketplace through a magnetic memory called MRAM. The reason that's interesting is that until about 5 years ago, this was the type of memory used in the space shuttle. So it's about 2.5 feet long, about 1.5 feet wide, and about 12 inches thick. It costs $250,000, and it stores 16 kilobytes. And you see this and you wonder why the economy is where it is today. And the way they make these memories is by taking small coils of iron and wrapping wire around them. And the reason the avionics applications like spacecraft need magnetic memory is when spacecraft go to the cosmic ray background, you can't use semiconductors. The cosmic rays generate random events in the material, and it's a problem for memory. You need something that's non-volatile, something that doesn't get destroyed. So you need magnetic memory, but unlike what all of us today can get in the bookstore, a little flash semiconductor memory for 10 bucks, that's 250,000 times larger. It's very hard to get a magnetic version of this that won't get destroyed in space applications. Until 2006, where a spin-off of Motorola called Freescale used a type of spintronic theory to develop a magnetically active random access memory. It's a 4 megabyte chip. It's not $250,000. It's about $100. Expensive on the scale of semiconductor memory, but a big savings for avionics. And suddenly, the government became interested in spintronics as well. So what I want to focus on in the remaining time we have is the scientific challenge. So all of these experiments and all of these exciting results came from the fact that billions of electrons were created with these techniques, and we could probe them. What we want to do in the physics community is to see if we can find one single electron, a pure quantum object, understand how this quantum object interacts with its environment, and with the help of Peter Allen, try and demonstrate how we can control the single spin with exquisite precision in an environment that could be very dirty, do it very rapidly, and look at the effect of an environment on a quantum mechanical state, which is one of the cornerstones of quantum mechanics. And in the end, with industry's help in some of this, it may be a solution to right now is a major problem, taking a $3.5 billion startup cost for building a fabrication line, which is one of the reasons you don't see new fabrication lines built so often in the United States. It's an enormous investment. And you can come up with a new paradigm for information processing, some way to get around this very expensive, relatively low return investment for a new type of technology. And their help comes from a lot of unexpected directions. And one of the nice things about being in Santa Barbara is that one can take advantage of the new Institutes for Science Innovation and experts such as Evelyn Hu in the California Nanosystem Institute and mix this idea of science, engineering, and materials to try and come up with a clever solution to this. And what's sort of the biggest surprise to a lot of us in this area is that arguably one of the more exciting spintronic materials is one that's generated excitement for a long time. And it's been the title of today's talk, diamonds. So we all know that diamonds have always heralded power, greatness, wealth, and of course emotion. And who can say that better than De Beers? And I love this recent ad, 2 months' salary. If she really loved you, would she expect you to spend that much on her? Okay. I should point out the fine text under here, De Beers, it's just a rock. But it's an exciting rock in that it has some extremely unusual properties. Diamond is a semiconductor, and what a lot of technologists realized and actually brought to the popular literature in this edition of Wired about 5 years ago is that through a series of accidents, also in a laboratory, some material science developed a way to actually solve a very long problem in materials to build artificial diamond. Single crystal, perfect diamond. As this title says here, $5 a carat, flawless, made in the lab. Surprise, synthetic diamonds are about to transform computing too. And I think the authors didn't appreciate exactly why, because their perspective was that diamond is fantastic for today's technology because it's arguably the best thermal conductor on the planet. If you hold a piece of diamond, how many of you have purchased a diamond? And those of you who are students will certainly purchase a diamond. If you hold a diamond and touch it, say, to an ice cube or to a flame, you have to drop it. It's an incredible conductor of heat. And those of you who do own a diamond, I encourage you to try this at home. But what's interesting in the laboratory is that you can actually build beautiful single crystals, now up to records of a few millimeters, absolutely perfect. It'll be interesting to see how this affects the marketplace, but a diamond is also a semiconductor, which most people don't appreciate, which means you could build devices out of diamond, and people don't do it because it's been expensive. And you can also grow diamond on silicon, which makes it compatible to a lot of today's technology. Even if you can build anything, if you grew today's technologies on diamond substrates, you could solve one of the big issues of getting heat out of your devices. So this has gotten a lot of interest. But for us today, it turns out that diamond is an incredibly exciting platform for quantum information technology. It's a system in which we're going to actually do these experiments of finding an individual electron playing with this quantum state one spin at a time. So for those of you in the room, and I assume that includes you, Jane, who have purchased diamonds, as you know, the value of the diamond is typically given by the four C's. So for the graduate students in the room, consider this a brief tutorial. Trust me. The value of the diamond is based on the color, the clarity, the carat, and the cut. Those are the four C's. And one of the reasons that some diamonds, less expensive diamonds, look yellow is because they have impurities in them. But for spintronics, we have a different set of four C's that we're going to worry about. And you can ask your jeweler about this. In our case, our four C's are coherence, control, communication, and coupling. That is, we'd like to create a quantum state that's coherent, we talked about before, unlike Bush, that you can actually have a phase that's coherent for a long period of time. You want to control this phase very cleverly. You'd like to communicate information between two quantum states. And you'd like to even wire things very close together. You'd like to wire maybe two individual electrons quantum mechanically from one end of the middle of technology, but from a physics perspective, to see actually how two quantum objects relate in a controlled manner, how you can move quantum information in a real system. So the interesting thing about diamonds, of course, is that like many semiconductors, they have impurities, and I love this quote that semiconductors are like people, it's the defects that make them interesting. And in diamond, there's a defect as well. And thanks to the magic of Peter Allen, I'm going to try and explain why diamond is so interesting. So if you have a series of diamonds, you try and find a particular one that you like, and Peter shows them this one in the back. And if you look in the diamond lattice is filled with carbon. So all these blue dots are carbon atoms that make up a lattice, which is known in physics as the diamond lattice. And if you'll see, there are occasional red dots in here as well, these red spheres. That's the nitrogen. And nitrogen is an impurity in diamond that we typically don't like, but occasionally there's a missing carbon atom, which is right here. And if a nitrogen atom happens to be near a carbon atom that's missing, it forms an unusual electronic state with one extra electron pinned in this area. Just one. And this one electron has a spin. And so whenever there's an impurity with a nitrogen atom around, we can find one spin. And what we want to do is either through optical techniques, we could flash a pulse of light to change the angle of the spin to do a type of quantum information processing, or we can bring in a magnetic field. And the closer we bring in the magnetic field, the faster it spins. We move the field away, it spins more slowly. I see Will is enjoying that. Yeah, no, actually, it's an amazing animation. And it's even correct. So, we do this in the laboratory. And for those of you who are interested, we'd be more than happy to show you the lab that's not too far away from this building. And for those of you that are from the ITT, this is called a laboratory. With things called equipment. In our case, lasers that can be used to address the spin and to detect it. And the nice thing about diamond is that if you illuminate it, it actually generates light. So how do these experiments work? I have just one slide to show you, because in fact, they're extremely simple. While this is a very large laboratory photograph, in fact, the experiments in diamond can be done on an office desk. And the idea is very simple. You take a small diode laser and you send the light through a microscope, and you focus it on an artificial diamond. And you scan the microscope around until you can find these electrons. And you would think that would be a hard thing to do. And then you take the light that comes out of these electrons. When you excite them with, say, green light, light will come out in the red. And what's interesting about diamond is that the light that comes out in the red only comes out with one particular orientation of the spin. So if you see light, you know that you've got one electron spin, in principle, and you also know the wave points. It's a very unusual aspect of diamond. And here's some data on room temperature on a synthetic diamond. When you scan the microscope objective around, a 20 micron square, and remember a micron is about the width of a human hair. So, there's a 2 micron bar, and half of that bar is a human hair width. You see these red spots. And if you look carefully, you can see bright ones and dark ones, and the bright ones are individual electrons right at the surface of the diamond in the focal plane of this objective. The dimmer ones are below this plane. They don't appear quite as nicely. But what you can do is park the microscope over one of these bright spots and then look at the light that comes out. And we do a measurement called an autocorrelation measurement, and all this means is to prove to yourself that this is just one electron and not just some light coming out of a piece of crap in the diamond. A non-engineered defect in the material. You need to convince yourself that only one photon is being emitted from only one electron, and the way you do that is a coincidence measurement. And by realizing the fact that you can't split the photon in two, so if you do a measurement of different time delays between a pair of detectors, you better not see anything when there's no time delay, because you can't split a photon into two. So there's no signal. And as you change the time delay, you begin to see the light come out. So you can do measurements to prove that there's one electron you're seeing with a simple optical microscope and a synthetic piece of diamond. So what can you do with this? Well, the one thing I want to appreciate that all of this is done at room temperature. So that is a big thing for quantum information. It's one of the few systems in the world that you can manipulate a quantum state at ambient temperatures. So there are lots of systems that, in fact, could be a little bit more robust than this, but almost none that work on the table, although they're not that at the beach. So how would you control the single electron spin state? Well, the simplest thing you could think about doing is to do spin resonance. And spin resonance means that you just put a small wire near this diamond electron, and you put an alternating electric field, a magnetoelectric field around it, and you try and resonate the electron spin between its two energy levels. Much like electron spin resonance or nuclear magnetic resonance or magnetic resonance imaging, you look for the specific signature, a specific frequency of energy that actually excites just these two spin states in diamond. And sure enough, here's some data that shows you at high frequencies in the gigahertz region, you can manipulate at very high frequencies the one spin. And for the experimentalists in the room, this is extremely impressive, a signal-to-noise ratio for one electron at room temperature, which is pretty hot, where you think these electrons will be hopping all over the place. But because diamond has such a big energy gap, you can do this at room temperature. So what else could you do? You can find one. You can find this energy between the states. The next thing you might want to do is control it. You'd actually like to take this top, if you like, this one electron, position it where you want in angle, and axis space, literally control it. And this is data showing that using RF pulses, using some high-frequency electronics, you can prepare this one electron, manipulate it at very high frequencies, and go on for very long time periods. And in very clean diamond, you can actually coherently control this to do nearly a million operations before this decoherence or this loss of information takes place. So this million is a very important number. It means you have a long time in which you can actually process this quantum state before it loses its quantum information to the material. So it looks very, very promising, and this gets even longer as you cool the material. But we want to do everything at room temperature. So I promise you this isn't going to get complicated. I see people looking disturbed. And it's only because we came very late last night. If you actually look at dirty diamond, or very cheap diamond, what you find is it's filled with these nitrogen impurities. It's really yellow. And for those of you looking to save money, by the way, you can take these diamonds and find a friend with a really high temperature furnace, and you can actually get the nitrogen out by pumping it away and make it a very good diamond. So, you know, don't let the excuse if I can't afford it get in the way. But if you look at the densities here, you have individual electrons that are separated a few microns in the material, okay? But the nitrogen is like a shotgun. It's everywhere, every few nanometers. Millions of nitrogens everywhere. And so a technologist might look at that and say, well, this is a mess. There are impurities all over the place. A physicist looks at this and says, this is an opportunity. Because I can take these electrons that are spaced a few microns apart and take all these nitrogen atoms that are very close and everywhere and think about them as making the quantum wire. If you think about all of these as individual bar magnets, we know if we put a bunch of magnets near each other, they can exchange information pretty well. So moving along these blue atoms is no problem. We know that we can actually have magnets aligned with each other. What we don't know is, can you move information from one electron into another atom quantum mechanically, conservatively, keeping all the information there for this full quantum wiring scheme? And I'm just going to show you in two slides that the answer is you can do it. And it was also a bit of a surprise. What the students in the lab did is they looked at the spin resonance line of one electron, and like any good student would do, they began to look at different parts of the material to make sure they could reproduce this all over the place. And every one of those red spots you saw in that image. But in a few red spots, they didn't see one peak, they saw two peaks. Split in energy by a very small amount. And if you calculate what this energy difference is and look at the system, it's pretty easy to convince yourself that what they saw was one electron spin exchanging information to just one nitrogen spin. If there were five nitrogen spins, there'd be five peaks. Six peaks. So in fact, what they were able to demonstrate is that you could quantum mechanically move information from one electron into the sea of impurities in a controllable fashion. And the way they proved that is like that video where you saw when you apply a magnetic field and you would change the frequency. They see these two peaks, which are shown here in a color code. This is their amplitude. And as you increase the magnetic field, at a certain point, one peak completely disappeared, and you would see just one. You would go from two to one at a very specific magnetic field. And that same event happened all over diamond and any type of material, always at the same magnetic field. And that magnetic field happens to be exactly the number in which, where the energy difference of the two spin states of the nitrogen atom is exactly the energy difference of the two spin states of the electron. So it means there's a resonant transfer of information from the electron to the nitrogen atom at a very specific magnetic field. And one last thing about this, which is intriguing, is that based on the location of this impurity in the lattice of atoms, you can change the way they align. So when you have two magnets, they can align along each other, co-aligned or anti-aligned. And you can tune that based on the location of the lattice based on this dipolar field. So I apologize for that verbiage. But for the physics and materials people in the room, I want at least to convey the amount of flexibility you have in engineering a piece of diamond for a quantum system. And that's one of the last things I want to talk about. In all of this field now with diamonds, we're relying on these synthetic diamonds with defects, right, that nature has put in for us. We want to move this type of physics into technology, like in all of our technology today. You want to engineer these defects to put them exactly where you want to build a quantum circuit for quantum processing. And then what you'd like to do is come up with a way to actually implant one impurity at a time into exactly a system you would like, in a way to build quantum wires, if you'd like, or quantum logic circuits, and look at how quantum information is entangled with its environment. So the way you'd like to do this is to shove these atoms in with a high energy, put them into a lattice, then heat the diamond to get rid of the damage that occurred in their track, and have a nice array. But I want to share with you that what some of the students are doing just in the last few months here in Santa Barbara with a group at Lawrence Berkeley Lab to build these types of quantum circuits. And if you draw a cartoon of this with PowerPoint, it looks pretty easy. And that's one of the job requirements of being a faculty member, is you learn experimental skills that mitigate themselves ultimately as finesse with PowerPoint. And it's very sad when you become impressed with your own PowerPoint slides. Sobering moment. The idea is to take a large beam of ions, collimate them into a beam that just has one or two, and send them through a very tiny aperture in a filter, and it hasn't hit a surface. And now you can see why you need this nice combination of material science, engineering, and physics even to approach this. You need to build instruments. You need to build something with like a 90 or 50 nanometer hole that the ions can shoot through. It has to be stable. It has to be done in vacuum. You have to start with a good diamond, and then you have to be able to study it. You need this enormous combination of collaborators to do something like this. And give you an example, this is a blow-up of just this tip of this atomic force microscope cantilever, which you can see the outline of here. And here are different series of holes that have been put into this cantilever. This is a 90 nanometer hole, so 900 angstroms in diameter. The ions are going to shoot through this hole into the material. And all this has to be done in UHV. There's a vacuum chamber, there's a source of ions that are accelerated into the system, they go into the cantilever, there's an observation port to look at it. It's an enormous investment in instrumentation just to be able to get the ions where you want. So, of course, we haven't done this. What we've done is just blast the ions into the surface, hoping a few of them go through a hole. It's the physics approach to see whether this is worth pursuing in a more careful and admittedly expensive venture. So what happens if you just blast the ions in? This is what you see. This is a piece of diamond, and you can, if you look here, you can see the outline of a cantilever. You see that? Okay. And what's glowing all around are the ions that miss the hole. No problem. And in this shadow should be that little 90 nanometer hole that we're hoping a few ions would straggle in. If we blow up the region around that hole, well, sure enough, we see some bright spots, like those red spots you saw in an earlier image. But we're hoping that these bright spots are these artificially engineered single electron states in diamond. And if we go ahead and study with our microscope objective what's happening in those bright spots, we can convince ourselves that each bright spot is producing one photon at a time, so it's one electron. And in this case, we did something interesting. We used an isotope of nitrogen, which is nitrogen 15. And the reason we chose a different isotope of the normal nitrogen, which is 14, is that you can distinguish this nitrogen from all the others in the diamond, because it has a very unique signature. And one of the unique signatures of this isotope is it interacts with the nuclear spins. And if you look, you can see that one peak is 2 now, with a very small splitting, because the nuclear spins are interacting with the electron, all at room temperature. So I'm showing you this, this is very recent, to show you that we now know, at least here at Santa Barbara, that you can artificially engineer individual electron spins into diamonds. It works. You have the entire periodic table you can begin to think about, and there's no physics that's keeping this from working. And this is just a final piece of data to show some very early data that you can actually generate a coherent state artificially in diamonds. So I think we're on the pathway to designing and building quantum machines. So in the last couple of slides, and with if all of this works, at the end you need to build a quantum machine that can communicate over long distances. And what you'd like to do, from our perspective, is to have one spin in a piece of diamond, two diamonds separated by some distance, and entangle them quantum mechanically in this unique superposition of states to really build a quantum system. And we need a way to really build this cartoon and put it on a chip, keep the photons in a small container, entangle these states in a controllable way. And that's when we rely on our colleagues in engineering, such as Evelyn Kuh and her students, which have used a lot of the techniques that Santa Barbara has developed for solid-state lighting, such as gallium nitride, and moved them into diamond to carve exquisite micron-scale structures out of diamond. So these, to my knowledge anyway, are the first small optical resonators made out of diamond, where Evelyn and her students, for example, made a disk here. It'd be 5 microns in diameter out of diamond, with the idea is like this cartoon that Peter has prepared for a show. A photon goes into this disk and goes around and around the periphery, like an optical fiber. It's just trapped there in this box. And as it moves around and around, it interacts with these electron spins, entangling them, moving information, and doing a type of quantum processing. You can build more exotic structures known as photonic band gap systems, where you put the electrons in this little cavity here, and photons are trapped in this box. And they also interact with these electron spins for processing. So this is work in progress, but again, I just wanted to show you this because it is an emphasizing aspect of how important it is to have this connection across the sciences and engineering. So where are we? Recently, we were asked to try and put together a timeline about where is this field going. I don't want to go through all of this, but it's interesting to see how rapidly this is happening. When the students discovered these unusually long spin lifetime states in semiconductors to some techniques that we demonstrated here, we can manipulate spins at nearly terahertz, actually above terahertz frequencies, There's some techniques that obviate the need to use magnets to move spins, which I don't have time to go into here, but by playing with the materials, you can get rid of the magnetic fields also. And a few years ago, something called the International Technology Roadmap for Semiconductors, which is essentially the Bible of the semiconductor industry to help them plan where they're going, have put spintronics, oddly enough, on their roadmap as what they view as a potential solution for their issues, which I think requires a certain amount of imagination to accept, but I applaud their enthusiasm. So where are we? So right now, things are looking pretty interesting from a physics perspective. We can find individual electron spins. We can stare at them. We can swirl them around at specific frequencies. We can understand a little bit on how they interact with their environment. But what I hope I'm sharing with you is the extraordinary number of very unexpected discoveries in this whole process. A lot of these were accidents in the laboratory. A lot of them weren't in research proposals. But they're beautiful examples, I believe, of experiment and theory working together to drive this area of research. Most of what we see has been unpredicted, both in the past, the present, and even the future. The work in Diamond was largely accidental. It provides incredible opportunities for an emerging field of quantum information, and it exploits our unique environment here at UCSB, where almost by design, Santa Barbara's been set up to move ahead in these areas. But we have a lot of challenges to both build and even think about how you would program a quantum machine. And for that, we're very lucky to have people such as the Microsoft Station Q project in the NanoSystem Institute thinking about, if I gave you a quantum computer tomorrow, could you actually program it? I couldn't, but you know, I'm sure Microsoft would like to, and I'm sure it'll be noted. So, you know, where are we? And I just wanted to end with sharing that none of this would be possible without some extraordinary set of graduate students and collaborators throughout the years who have certainly made it enjoyable for me to be here, and ultimately would be the ones that are responsible for moving this field forward. Some of them actually find it so exciting they marry each other. The dinner conversations are probably just barely imaginable. And of course, I'm very fortunate and thankful to have an extraordinary set of graduate students today in my group that have been responsible for everything that I've shown you. So thank you very much. And are there any questions? Yes.
What is around the natural isotopes?
That's a good question. So when you make diamond, there are some natural isotopes of carbon that provide nuclear spins as a source of losing information. And there is a solution to that, and maybe you could help us with that, is to use an isotopically pure methane as a source of creating synthetic diamond. And right now, there are relatively few startup companies in the world that are doing this, and they're very reticent to give us the information about how they do this, for obvious reasons. It's proprietary. And right now, they're selling everything they can make. But we're negotiating with one of them to do exactly that, actually to make nuclear-free diamond. I hope we'll be able to do it, unless you would like to do that here. Any other questions about diamond or? That's also a really good question, and it's something that's actually bothered us a lot. Why this should work so well in diamond? There must be other materials that this should work in well too. It's a really good question, and we've been encouraging a lot of our theory colleagues to think about this, because the answer has got to be yes. There have to be other things like diamond. I don't believe this is the only example, and I think right now no one knows the answer to that. But it's clearly a really important question. Yes. Well, Diamond has a low spin orbit coupling, which means it has a longer spin lifetime, but it also means it's harder to manipulate with the low spin orbit coupling. So you need to have a delicate balance between the right amount of coupling to give you an enhanced lifetime, but enough coupling that you can do something. And the reason that those other materials I showed you work at room temperature, like zinc selenide and gallium nitride, they also have a low spin orbit coupling. So you're right, you do need that. But there's got to be something we're missing in this field that allows us to predict what materials would work as well as diamond. Now, it's maybe silicon carbide. But I think the jury's out. It's not string theory, so sometimes it's a challenge to get people in this building to think about it. I don't know why I said that, really. I'm sure I'll pay for that.
All right, well, thank you very much, David. And before we... Before we close, there are a few other honors that go along with the lectureship, in addition to having the opportunity to speak to all of us. One is that you get appointed to the committee for next year. And in fact, you get to chair the lecture committee next year.
Oh, really?
Yes. This is a new way we've developed to encourage participation in committee work. Tell them afterwards that what's involved. But also, there is a check and a medallion that I would like to ask Chancellor Yang to present now.
Well, thank you very much. Do I need a check? Have you signed it?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
There's a reception.